know that thou art true, and teachest the way of God in truth. Neither carest thou for any man, for thou regardest not the person of men. Tell us therefore, what thinkest thou? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, Why tempt ye me, ye hypocrites? Show me the tribute money. And they brought him unto him a penny. And he saith unto them, Whose is the image on the superscription? And they said unto him, Caesar's. And then he saith unto them, Render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things which are God's. When they heard these words, they marveled and left him and went their way. Now, all of us know that the Pharisees were Jesus' most vocal critics from day one. And they now, after having heard the last three parables that we've studied over the last two chapters, that really were parables designed to condemn them and what they were doing to judge their behavior, they're now more determined than ever to get rid of Jesus and to do something to silence him. And so it says in verse 15 that they took counsel. They got together, they put their heads together to see how they might entangle him in his talk. The word entangle simply just means to lay a trap. Their desire was, they were coming up with a plan to try to lay some kind of a trap. Now, I'll remind you that all of this is taking place right there in the temple. All these last three parables have been told right there in the temple. It come right on the heels of them questioning Jesus' authority. And of course, prior to that, he had turned over the tables and the money changers and cleansed the temple and all of that. Well, all of this is still transpiring right there in the temple. Amongst a lot of people who were still very much in support of Jesus. He had still had a lot of followers. So the religious Jews are very reluctant in the way that they are going to approach Jesus and attack him and take any kind of action against him directly, simply because they're concerned about the masses. The multitudes that are following Jesus, they're for fear that they'll turn against them. So they're being very cautious here when they make this plot to try to get him to say something that would incriminate him in the eyes of Rome. That's their motive with this. Now keep in mind that though the Jews had their own set of laws and their own local government, all of that fell under the umbrella of the Roman Empire. Ultimately, they answered to Rome, okay? And so if they could get Jesus to make some kind of a statement that would be deemed criminal according to Roman law, then they could report him to the authorities, have him arrested, potentially be convicted and executed, and that would take care of their whole problem, right? That's what they're wanting. They don't care how he's silenced as long as he gets silenced. So they come up with this very, very deceitful attempt to entangle him or trick him, if you will, or lay a trap for him. And so I want you to notice how deceitful they are. Verse 16 says, And they sent out unto him their disciples with the Herodians. Now let's talk about that for a minute. The Pharisees themselves, the official Pharisees, okay, the officials, wore very distinguishable dress. They were recognizable by most anybody in Jerusalem would have known who they were simply by their dress, especially Jesus. And so if they were to walk up and approach Jesus with this question, immediately he'd say, okay, they're antagonistic, they're trying to harm me. So they recruit what the scripture here in verse 16 refers to as some of their disciples, some of their followers, that these were people that were identified with the Pharisees, but were not official, held any kind of official position that would have them dressed in a robe or the special garb, okay? In other words, they're kind of undercover. They sympathize, they identify with the Pharisees, but they're not officially recognizable as a Pharisee. Presumably, they could take their disciples, and they're operating kind of undercover, to slip in very subtly and in a very non-antagonistic way towards Jesus, even using a little bit of flattery, which we'll read about in just a moment. They do that in verse 16. They call him master, make some complimentary remarks and this sort of thing. And they presumably think that he would not recognize them as being antagonistic, but just being someone that had questions, someone that was just asking some innocent questions, and hopefully he would respond in a way that would incriminate him, they could get him in trouble. Okay, so essentially these were Pharisees in disguise, fishing for a response that would get Jesus in trouble. But I want you to notice also who they drew in to this plot. It's the Herodians, as it says in verse 16. They recruited them as well. Now let's talk about them. And there's not a lot to be known other than they, in simple terms, their roots were in the Herod family, which was a broad family, Herod Antipas, Herod the Great, Herod the Tetrarch. We've studied about all of those, okay? The Herods had deep ties to Rome, okay? They had a lot of powerful Herods, people of the Herod family, okay? And they had a very loose, shallow attachment to Judaism. So for the Pharisees, normally the Herodians would have been taboo to even associate with, okay? For the Pharisees to ally themselves with the Herodians, it would be very unusual. But in this particular case, it suits their purpose very well. They normally would not have considered Herodians as allies. They would have considered them as traitors, really, irreligious traitors to the Roman government by the Pharisees. But in this particular situation, they fit the bill because if it worked out, the questions that their undercover disciples are about to ask Jesus, if they could get Jesus to say incriminating words and the Herodians were there present, their sympathizers with Rome, okay, they would be the perfect witnesses to say, look, we heard him say it ourselves, what he said, okay? Now, folks, when I'm telling you all these things, it's not like I'm smart and figured all this out, okay? I study a lot of smart guys that pull all this together for us tonight, okay? So if they can get these undercover Pharisees to present these questions very subtly and very innocently, get Jesus to pop off, make some incriminating remarks regarding Rome, have these Roman sympathizers witnessing it, and then the charges could stick, perhaps, and they would be their problem would be solved. And so, verse 16 the second part of the verse is the question, okay? Or no, excuse me. These are their flattering words. They say, Master, we know thou art true, and thou teachest the way of God in truth. Neither carest thou for any man, for thou regardest not the person of men. So they've come, and they're addressing him in a flattering way. First of all, they call him Master. In the Jewish, in that particular crowd, anybody referred to as a master would be considered a rabbi, someone who had proper training, someone that had their expertise in teaching and interpreting the law and Jewish tradition. So very important people were called masters. So to be called master, even mistakenly, would have tended to flatter most men, okay? So they come at Jesus with these flattering master, and then they follow it up with these affirming words, the ones that we just read. We know thou art true. We know that thou teachest the way of truth. And essentially where they're putting it on thick, like my grandma used to say. They're really putting it on thick, and they're basically saying, we know you're the right guy, and we know you're of God, and we really think you're sincere. You know, they're coming at him with a, you know, they're really wanting to put their best foot forward to get him to fall for this. We know this is a fat lie. They didn't think he was true. They're trying to trick him. But notice verse the last part of 16. They say, for thou regardest not the person of men. They're saying we know that you are not easily intimidated. You can't be bought. You're not a respecter of persons. You're always going to be fair. And so they continue on with all of this stuff, really coming with their best foot forward. And what they're saying is true. Jesus can't be bought. And he can't, he's not a respecter of persons. All these things are true and accurate, but they didn't think they were true. They were just saying it. They didn't believe it at all. They're trying to set him up again so they can ask this question. They think by appealing to his pride and perhaps, like most men, his ego, maybe stroking it a little bit, call him master, brag on him a little bit, get him puffed up a little bit, so when it comes time to answer this question, he may very arrogantly pop off the exact words that they're looking for him to say. Okay? And, of course, here's the question. Verse 17. They say, tell us, what thinkest thou? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not? That's the question. Now, the tribute that they're speaking of here is they're speaking of taxes. Okay, we're going to talk about that for a moment. The word that's rendered here tribute is a word that we get our word census from. Okay, so again, smart people teach me this. I teach it to you. They're referring to here a particular tax, not just any tax, but they had what was called a poll tax in Rome. A poll tax was a tax on every single individual, a fee that had to be paid by every individual in the Roman Empire every year. The purpose for censuses. Remember when Mary and Joseph had to go to Bethlehem for the census? The purpose of those censuses, the primary purpose, was to do inventory, if you will, count the people, take record, so they could collect the poll tax on every person. They could hold every person fee to the fire to pay their poll tax. And so it was a yearly tax that every person had to pay to the Roman Empire. Now let's talk about taxes, ironically, okay? And I'm not gonna go where you think I might wanna go with it, but taxes are a necessary evil for the sake of this study. We'll talk about it, okay? They are a necessary evil for a developed society. You can't argue against that, because without taxes, there could be no functioning government, right? And without that, and you say, well, that sounds real good. No functioning government. We're all in better shape. But the truth of the matter is that's not practical, okay? It's not something that we really would really enjoy if it were the case, because we want the services that government provides, that they're organized to provide, okay? Fire department, police department, judicial system, not to mention the military to keep us safe, and all of those things and many more are for our benefit, right? Highways, jails, public utilities, the list goes on and on. These are things that make our lives safer and more harmonious. And it's for those reasons that God ordained government. Now, you may or may not know, from a theological standpoint, there's three entities would it be organization? What's the other term? It's marriage, institutions. I'm sorry, that's the word I was looking for. It's marriage, church, and government are the three institutes that God ordained, and He ordained them for the good. Now we have distorted all of them, almost. Okay, but those were ordained of God for the purpose, for the betterment of His creation, His mankind. Okay, and it's not the design of man that we have government. It's by God's design. But obviously, it doesn't take long for man to mess it up, right? Man comes along, it doesn't take very long at all for him to distort what God has ordained. And so the taxes that are naturally going to have to flow from the people to the government, they become excessive. The proceeds that come in get misused, and eventually By most every government, you start having problems. And of course, Rome was no different. They had way too much spending going on. They were demanding too much of their people. It had become oppressive. The empire of Rome boasted in its advancement. It boasted in its military power, all the many services they had available, roads, aqueducts, and all those things that were very advanced for the age. They boasted of those things, but they did not come cheap. They had to be paid for. And so they had a land tax, they had income tax, they had custom taxes, they had tax on goods, and they had this yearly fee, this particular thing we're reading about, that every person in the empire was required to pay, which was a poll tax. Well, the poll tax, back to our lesson, was a particular affront to the Jewish people, because in the minds of the Jewish people, they belonged to God. They didn't belong to Caesar. And they resented anything that suggested otherwise. And so by taking a census, the Romans would record their names and have a record of them, keeping them on roll, if you will, inventory of their people. And then the payment of the poll tax being forced, the Jews paying that poll tax, they felt as though they were making a little bit of an acknowledgement that they belonged to Rome by paying this tax. And so it was a bitter, bitter pill for them to swallow, for the Jews to pay the poll tax. It was something that the Jews despised, this tribute that's being spoken of in verse 17. And so it's no accident that the question that they've involved here is along that subject, because it's a touchy subject between the Jews and between the Romans. Knew the Jews hated it. And so when they ask, is it lawful to pay this poll tax to Caesar or not, they thought they were putting Jesus in a very bad, they thought they were boxing him in. If he answered in the affirmative, yes, it's lawful, then he would enrage all the Jewish multitudes that were around him, who at that point, most of them still admired him, okay? Still had quite a following. It was not going to last long. Within a few days, they'll be gone. But so that would set him, put him in trouble with the multitudes, in which case, if that happened, the temple leaders could do with him what they wanted. They could arrest him and accuse him of blasphemy, which they ultimately do anyway. But all of those things without any kind of fallout or interference. But what they really hoped for in this particular deal was for him to answer no, that it's not, for him to declare that it is an unjust tax and it's not lawful to pay Caesar. They were wanting him to say that, because in that case, they could, with the witnesses, the Roman sympathizers being present, they could have immediately had the Roman authorities arrest him for insurrection and take him away, and their problem would be solved. He would be silenced. And that's what they were hoping for. So all of this has been it's more to this than you think when you first read it. It's a very calculated thing that they've done here. And the whole deal, the flattery, the Pharisees under the guise of just being just temple worshipers coming together with the Herodians, and then this particular question, it's all very well thought out, and they're thinking that they're going to trick Jesus Christ. They really thought they'd cut a rusty here on this deal. They thought they were doing something, but what they didn't take account for was verse 18. Verse 18 says, "But Jesus perceived their wickedness." He's the Son of God. He knew before they ever walked up who they were and what they were up against. And of course, we'll study the remainder of this text the next time we're together. But there's no fooling the Lord Jesus Christ. And they find out very quickly that they couldn't even, with all this plotting and all this scheming, they thought they had him boxed in. And the way he answers it, and the way he really just blows up their plan is pretty cool. But that's what Jesus does. He can bring down his enemies in any way he wants. So let's stand. Appreciate you guys very much. I hope you have a good remainder of the week, and go home and get some rest. We'll come back here on Sunday, okay?